Right now, we don't have anything to talk about, but we'll bring in David Tarachuk anyways. It is time for the media beat. David joins us, of course, on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast him during the week and also right after our noon news here on Robinhood Radio. He's a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. His own website, the website is themediabeat.us, and we'd love to have him here always on a Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Hello there. Good to be with you from the media capital of the world, New York City.
Well, I was joking around when I said there's not really that much to talk about out there. But...
No, we have a nation at the moment suffering the extreme trifecta of a health crisis, severe health crisis with COVID-19, a racial crisis in the wake of the killing, the murder, indeed, of... well, that's still to be proven in court, but I think everyone accepts it as being a murder committed by police officer or officers of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and of course the economic crisis that is consequent on the COVID crisis. Three prongs holding this nation pinned down at the moment, and which of those is going to be the most long-lasting, anyone can tell.
You know, it's strange to look at this. I see people say that these incidents show that there's a resurgence of racism in America. And I think the media's got that wrong. I think the only reason we think there's a resurgence of racism in America is because of social media. 15 years ago, we didn't have social media where people could video anything they want and put anything out there. And now we are seeing really... probably what has been going on ever since we supposedly were tackling the problem with racism back with what happened in Los Angeles and after the shooting of Martin Luther King. We really have not come anywhere, really, when you look at it, dealing with racism in this country, when would truth be said?
Well, it's hard to measure because, of course, everything has been conducted so much in the way of racist incidents have been, until now, pretty well carried out in some degree of secrecy, at least. Every now and again, of course, a horrific incident will break out, like in the early 1990s, the Rodney King beating in Los Angeles, and of course that did blow up into a massive crisis. But you're right, social media and the fact that we all carry a camera with us now, a video camera, which gets audio as well as pictures, and much more is, it's not exactly transparency, but what it is casting a much fiercer light on what might otherwise be happening in dark corners. And there's the impression that it's cresting into a huge wave. That's probably not the case, but what it is, perhaps much more disturbingly, is illustrating what probably has been going on all the time, just unreported. And that's a desperately pessimistic view of life in America, but I don't think it's wholly inaccurate. You just have to journey out of what one's as the media. We just have to venture out of our safe climes and the safe surroundings that we spend most of our time in, and go out into what I can call the real America, and try just living for a little while away from our media centers, and I think our view would change, and then we'd have a greater sense of what the reality is on the ground, and that these occasions that are now being so horrifically and quite rightly publicized, and the response to them also entirely understandable, of mass protests in the streets, even though they take place at a time when we're supposed to be taking good care of our physical health and not gathering, and in fact what's happening is that we are We're seeing something now, the flames being fanned, of course, but the fire is always there, and outbursts of this fire are going on all the time. Not every minute of every day, by any means, but certainly part of the pattern of American life. And the sooner we we own up to that and face it as coolly as we can, just a sense of yes, this is a reality, and this is a horrific reality, and we have to change our customs, and in particular our law enforcement, in a way that will prevent it from going on and on and on the way it has, the better this country will be, and the better it will be living up to its own supposed ideals.
Yeah, it's when you look at this, I just look at the response by our government, not necessarily the people. I think Black Americans have had it, and I don't think that this is going away anytime soon. I think that the government has to deal with it. We have a president that wants to be combative with it, but some very strange things have happened. And just take a look at Jim Mattis. I mean, this guy is no darling of the liberals. Okay,
absolutely. The man known as Mad Dog Mattis, not a nickname given to him by Trump, which Trump claims, but a general known as Mad Dog Mattis for his own tendency to get rough with the opposition. Understandable, perhaps, excuse me, understandable as a military man, perhaps, but thought of by his own colleagues to be something of an extreme exponent of the military arts. But yes, the Mad Dog Mattis is now come out absolutely in condemnatory terms of the president's reaction to the current crisis. And it's not as if the present Secretary of State for Defense, I mean, Mattis resigned that position 18 months ago, but the present occupant, Mark Esper, who seems to be a lot of the time in lockstep, literally in lockstep with Trump walking across Lafayette Park this week, incidentally. But he certainly wanted to distance himself from the idea of sending in the military and using the military to, in Trump's horrific phrase, dominate the streets of America. So, yes, he's... and now, of course, not that it's any great surprise, but one lone and brave senator, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, has now not exactly come out against him, but certainly cast so much doubt about her own ability to support him any longer you get a sense of the Trump really not being entirely in control of the GOP now, and that's probably the first time that's happened since he started to get such an incredible grip, fear-inspiring grip on the party after winning the nomination and then the presidency so surprisingly.
You know, people look at the military. So many people don't understand the military. You might not agree with the politics and the policy of what the military does, but the one thing about the military is once you're within the military, it doesn't matter if you're a general, a sergeant, a private, or whatever, you follow orders, and that's why the military can move things so efficiently around the world, and politics.
Well, I think the efficiency is somewhat debatable, Marshall, but yeah, they have a capacity to get things done. That's true. Whether they're effective or not is another question entirely.
That's it, because an order is an order, and there's no thinking about it. When you're given the order, you follow the order. And then to have a general like General Mattis and other members of the military that are now retired, understanding the Constitution and the use of the military, how it can be used, and the depth and the need of the understanding is just not there at the top at the White House. And it's a shame to see, but our president has no idea of the Constitution and how you separate the local National Guards from the U.S. military, and his options as president to send those troops out against Americans.
Yeah, and the entire media landscape has gone into another form of hysteria about that. Of course, as I think we're getting more and more used to doing. I think the saddest example of this is the response that a paper that normally a newspaper and a website gets a lot of respect from me. The New York Times has behaved on this issue so appallingly. They printed a quite rightly, I think, in my view, printed a an op-ed by the proponent of military action in the streets, Tom Cotton, senator for Arizona. Not a very well argued piece, and in many ways it should have been better edited. But the principle of whether or not they should carry pieces like that is what's at issue. And the paper is now in an appalling mess. It's holding a meeting today of its staff. Its own staff are in rebellion against the top editors for having carried this opinion piece. And I stress that it is an opinion piece, not a piece of journalistic reporting, an opinion piece from a politician. And the New York Times itself put its own headline on that piece, just boldly putting it forward as an argument in very few words, send in the troops. Such an inflammatory headline, and the copy itself is kind of okay, but you know, accepting from whence it comes, but includes highly debatable, and indeed highly disputable assertions of fact that I don't think on an old working day at the New York Times would ever have got past muster. Now the Times is finally agreeing in a public statement that it fell short of its own editorial standards, and it was put together in too much of a rush. I mean, that's never any excuse for a journalistic organization, of course. It is the news business, after all. Things do happen fast, and they have to be responded to in a very fast way as well. But we've got this awful situation now of the Times abandoning its commitment to carry opinion of a diverse kind, and looking like it's turning into a censor of unacceptable right-wing opinion because of the unhappiness, perfectly understandable unhappiness, by the way, of a lot of its staff. This is no way to run a railroad. It's certainly no way to run a newspaper, and I'm really sorry to see it happening that way, especially over such a sensitive issue as this, and over such a bad piece of writing from someone who should certainly have the space, and the principal agreement is still intact that a newspaper ought to reflect all shades of opinion, at least be prepared to carry pieces and then carry counter pieces if they have to. But in this case, they've got themselves into an awful, awful tangle, and it's kind of an example of how hysterical the entire nation is getting over all of this. It is outrageous that cops should murder an individual, and even though they're being filmed, act as if they have impunity. Now there are murder charges, and aiding and abetting the murderer is now a charge against the three officers who were there, as well as Derek Chauvin, who is charged with the second-degree murder. And we'll see how it pans out in court. But the event itself is horrific. The response to it has been so fragmented and so hysterical that I think it cries out for some calm, settled, determined leadership. And as you say all too pointedly, Marshall, we're not getting that. And the media's job is all that much more important now in consequence of that. And I'm afraid some of the best exponents of the craft in our country are not living up to their own standards.
Well, the whole problem is a newspaper that does the editorialize has the absolute privilege, and they should, with their space, present opposing viewpoints. The question is, what has happened in this country to real editors? If that letter comes into the New York Times and a real editor takes the time to look at it, it can get, and then once again sends back to the person who sends it in and said, I find these points in question, they're not really being reality. Can you explain why you put them in here, so the person can better do that and then send a letter in? That's one thing. I think the editing in this country has gone by the wayside. It used to be a craft that was practiced and practiced evenly, where editors actually prevented things like this from happening. And now it seems that, like you say, everything is so rush, that an editor isn't a true editor anymore.
Well, and in this particular case, it's sad to say that the chief editor of that part of the paper, and I keep stressing again that it's the opinion part of the paper, not the news part of the paper, but the overall editor of the opinion pages had to admit that he had not read the piece before it was published. You know, while we're on the subject of the New York Times, let me say this. It's a big organization, and, you know, I'm making a point these days, and you and I have agreed that this is a good thing to do, that I should be singling out examples of very good journalistic work now and again. In fact, I should do it on a regular basis. And indeed, my pick this week of some of the best journalism emerging from this horrible, messy situation has in fact come from the New York Times this week. The 8+ minutes of that horrific video which went viral and caused the outrage in the first place over the killing of George Floyd was analyzed very effectively in a journalistic manner by the New York Times' own video team. They got a hold of other videos besides the one taken by the one that ended up on social media, the one that sort of focuses most closely on the officer pinning George Floyd down by his knee to the neck. But they took in other sources as well, and police dispatch audio as well, and put together a very well-crafted analysis to explain exactly how things went that terrible time. And their own video lasts a little over 9 minutes, but it picks apart the actual events. And for a piece of journalistic clarity, I think it's something rarely equaled in this past week of coverage. I mean, a total kudos from me to the New York Times for that. And I think it's worth holding on to the fact that journalism, when done well, is a vital provides a vital contribution to the national conversation. And it's shocking to see, you know, how bad it can be when it's done poorly, as it was in the case of the op-ed from the senator from Arizona.
Hey, you know, we need in this country, and I will go back to Watergate and before that, we need major newspapers around the country to have standards and to get into stories like they used to do. And they're getting competition with one another, but the country benefits because more information comes out. Right now, that statement by Mattis shows that there is a huge chasm in this country, including the military. Not only the population that is called the haters, people who think that they just hate Trump, that it's not what Trump does. between the other 30%. And like you said at the beginning, what's tearing this country apart right now is not only that, but you've got a pandemic, you've got the economy, you have all of this. We need somebody, we need something out there that can take the nation and calm it down, whether it's a newspaper, whether it's a television station, whether it's a politician. Somebody has got to step forward and just start to settle things down, because if it doesn't settle down, we really are heading for an unbelievable explosion right before Election Day.
Yeah, and the role of the media is vital in this, as I say, and calm heads and steady hands is what is certainly needed. And where do we find them? Well, we're finding them working well in some places, and even in those good places, they sometimes fail. Such is human nature, I guess. But we're the stakes are very high at the moment, and it is a crying shame that of all publications, the New York Times should be letting us down on this one particular issue. And I hope this blows over quickly. It is, after all, only sort of 800 words from a somewhat untypical U.S. senator, but of course passions run high, and the other thing, of course, is that something not to be forgotten in all of this is that journalists are human beings too. Not only are they fallible, but they're also human beings and open to all sorts of unavoidable human emotions, not least among them in these troubled times the simple one of fear. One very clear message out of the staff discontent at the New York Times at the moment is that black members of staff feel very threatened by the fury that this piece by Senator Cotton has kicked up. They feel themselves to be at physical risk as they go about their jobs from now on. And that's understandable. And that needs to be factored into the situation, too. But it simply makes clear yet again that the media needs to be cool in times like this. It needs not to be hasty. It needs not to be hysterical. And as I say, the stakes are very high. The task is very important. And the sense of responsibility needs to be stressed at every turn.
Why don't we take a step back from that, because that and the pandemic is really top of our news. But you take a look, and the problem we have right now is that we are a globe now. We are all so close together. The countries that depend on the United States to help them around the world have to look at this and just be in amazement, because the United States is no longer a country that our allies can really depend on.
Oh, that's true. And then the small, a small example of that this week is in the way that the small, struggling country of Kosovo has been basically betrayed by the Trump administration, when the only reason that Kosovo exists in the first place is that America came to its aid when it was being so sorely threatened by the extremists of Serbia. And then the NATO military operation was launched by the Clinton administration, and then that resulted in the Daytona Agreement, actually forged in Ohio, and peace came. Not a rather tense peace, but peace has settled on the Balkan region. But one small country at the center of much of the fighting was created by this act of international responsibility on the part of the United States, and Trump has reversed that course, and now is leaving Kosovo in the lurch. So it can vary from that specific and small country example to, yes, a very broadly spread feeling amongst America's allies. How can they possibly rely on the United States of America anymore? It's a major question, and it's a matter of great concern for the globe as a whole. And, you know, it goes not just to economic and strategic matters, but, of course, now we're in the middle of the most appalling global health crisis, in which the United States is not playing its full part. In fact, it's going the way of all Trump decisions, which stress America first, and as a consequence, America is missing from the global entity, the World Health Organization, the finance has been withdrawn from it, and calumnies are cast at it, and yet it's the world's only real hope in tackling this massive health challenge. It's a global problem, and it needs global solutions. And America stepping back and folding its arms and sticking out its tongue and hurling insults is going to be no help at all. In fact, it's going to run very much counter to any effort to make us all safe and healthy again.
It's just a weird way to look at what's going on here. At the age of 67, I've seen a lot in this country, but I've never seen this country so wrapped up in itself and so unstable in itself that the rest of the world looks at us in actual amazement. This is something I've never seen before. Yes, we've had our enemies look at us certain ways, but never... we've always been looked as a bastion of light. I know that sounds very sophomoric, but really the rest of the world always looked upon the United States as they used to say, that great city on the hill, and it's not that way anymore. It's just truly unbelievable what has unfolded in the last 3.5 years.
Yeah, and just take a view, take a little tour around the world's main media outlets internationally, and you'll see that feeling of yours borne out again and again and again. The world is looking on and shaking its head at the state of America now, and the lack of its leadership is being very, very sorely felt.
All right, David, we will check with you again in a week and see where we stand or not stand around the world and in our own nation as well. Thank you very much for your update here on the Media Beat.
Good. I look forward to talking to you next week.
Take care. David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. You can find him also on demand at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on David Tarachuk with the Media Beat.